This is Audible.
Coruscant, lower levels, 10 standard years after the Yuuzhan Vong War.
The object of her desire was walking down the opposite side of the sky lane, moving along a pedwalk so choked with vines and yorick coral that even the Zap Gangs traveled single file. He was 2 levels below and 10 meters ahead, and he kept stopping to study door membranes and peer into the windows of coral-crusted buildings. Then he would just stand there in the gloom, alone and empty-handed, as though no Jedi need fear the dangers of the Undercity, as though he ruled the twilight depths down where Coruscant changed to Yuuzhan Tar. Jason Solo was as arrogant as ever, and this time it would be his undoing. The angle was perfect. Almost too perfect. If she struck now, he would be dead almost as soon as he hit the pedwalk. Nobody would know that his death had been an execution, not even Jason. But Alima Rar needed them to know. She needed to see the shock of recognition in Jason's eyes when he collapsed, to feel his fear burning in the Force as his heart cramped into an unbeating knot. She needed to hold him dying in her arms and suck the last breath from his lips, to hear his father roaring curses, and watch his mother wailing in grief. That last part, Alima needed more than anything. She had spent years pondering what she could take from Leia Solo that would be the equal of everything Leia had taken from her. An instep and 5 toes? That would be a fair trade for the half of a foot Leia had cut off on Tanupe. And the princess's eyes and ears were due for the Leku she had severed aboard the Admiral Ackbar. But what of the giant spider sloth to which Leia had fed her in the Tanupian jungle? How was Alima to match that? Because this was not about revenge, not about cruelty. It was about balance. The spider sloth had nearly killed her, had bitten her almost in half and left her slender dancer's body roped with white scars. An ugly, lopsided thing that only a Rodian would desire. Now Alima had to take something equal from Leia, something that would shatter her to the core. Because that's what Jedi did. They served the balance. Eager to keep her prey in sight, Alima hurried back toward the nearest pedestrian bridge. This region was teeming with ferals, the half-wild survivors of the Yuuzhan Vong invasion, who continued to live a primitive existence deep in the Undercity. She started across the bridge. Her Leku stump began to nettle, and she wondered if someone was watching her. Jason was nowhere to be seen. She drew her lightsaber and advanced up the pedwalk, half expecting to feel the emitter nozzle of a lightsaber pressing into her ribs just before Jason activated the blade. The most dangerous thing Alima met was a foraging scrap pack, which skittered away into a tangle of slash vines almost as soon as she saw it. The only other oddity was the sporadic team of ferals disappearing through a door membrane near the corner of the building. They were of many species, Bith, Bothan, Hodin, and they were all bearing the carcasses of dead animals, including hawk bats, granite slugs, a few slimy yanskaks. Once there was even a Shevin clutching what looked like a dead Ewok in its huge claw. They were probably just ferals returning home with the day's hunt, but as Alima passed in front of the doorway, she kept her lightsaber at the ready. No one leapt out to attack her, but she sensed a trio of Force presences on the other side of the membrane. Alima did not bother to investigate. Had it been Jason lurking behind the door, she would have sensed nothing at all. Instead, she exchanged her lightsaber for a short blowgun and armed it with a small cone dart from a sealed container in her utility belt. She had 8 more such darts, one for each of the Solos and the Skywalkers, plus 2 extras, all fashioned from the stinger and venom sac of a deadly Tanupian wasper. Alima raised the blowgun to her lips and stepped around the corner, her body already purring with the sweet tingle of murder. But Jason seemed determined to disappoint her. The pedwalk was empty and dark, and there was not a sentient soul in sight. There was no ambush. The only danger Alima sensed was the same faint tingle she had been feeling since before crossing the bridge. Alima returned to the door she had just passed, the one all the ferals had been entering with their carcasses. Dark and ringed by a thick crust of yuric coral, it looked more like a cavern mouth than a doorway. She pressed a nerve bundle on the door jamb, and the membrane pulled aside. Standing opposite her was a brawny Nikto with a scaly green face and a ring of small horns encircling his eyes. He studied her for an instant, then rasped,
"Wrong door, lady. Nothing inside to interest you."
Alima started to reach for the guard in the force, but stopped when her danger sense grew so strong that her remaining leku began to tingle as well. She pointed her blowgun at the Nikto's feet, and using a force suggestion to ensure he would obey, commanded,
"Wait."
The expression in the Nikto's eyes changed from threatening to surprised to obedient, and Alima extended her force awareness in all directions. To her astonishment, she brushed a cold presence, something dark and bitter, back up the pedwalk near the bridge. But when she turned to look in that direction, the darkness vanished, and the danger tingle in her leku subsided as quickly as it had come. Alima continued to study the pedwalk for a few moments, trying to digest what she had felt. Someone was definitely stalking her, but it could hardly be Jason. Even had he been careless enough to let her detect him, and he wouldn't have been, the Jason she remembered was anything but bitter. Solemn and brooding, certainly, but also devoted and sincere. So who was stalking her? Alima turned back to the Nikto, gesturing past him with her blowgun.
"Did Jason Solo go in there?"
"Why would someone like that come here?"
The Nikto tried to sound uncertain, but Alima could sense his lie in the subtle tremor of his force presence.
"There's nothing inside but housing."
"You dare lie to me?"
Alima used the force to raise her crippled arm, then grabbed him by the throat.
"To a Jedi?"
Still calling on the force, she lifted him off his feet and squeezed until she heard the happy crackle of crushed cartilage. The Nikto's mouth fell open, and a terrible gurgle came from his throat. Alima continued to hold him aloft until his eyes rolled back and his feet began kicking. Only when she sensed the other two guards stepping into the doorway did she drop the Nikto on the balcony and turn to find a pair of tentacle-faced Quarren bringing their old E-11 blaster rifles to bear. Alima waved her blowgun, using the force to turn their weapons aside, then touched their minds with hers to search out the doubt she knew would be foremost in their thoughts, the fear that they could not stop her from entering, that they would be the ones who died.
"You do not need to die,"
Alima spoke in a force whisper, so soft and compelling that it sounded like a thought.
"You do not need to stop anyone."
The guards relaxed.
"No one is coming through the door,"
she purred. As Alima passed between the Quarren, she noticed that one of them had only three face tentacles. Their beady eyes began to focus on her, and their old E-11 blaster rifles started to swing back toward her. Alima tapped the muzzles of their weapons aside.
"You do not need to see me."
Their eyes grew unfocused again, and they turned their attention back to the door. Once Alima was safely inside, she faced the two Quarren.
"You know me well,"
she said, continuing to speak in her force whisper.
"We have been talking for several minutes."
The Quarren shifted their stances, opening a place for Alima, and turned their heads slightly toward her. Now Alima spoke in her normal voice.
"Where do you suppose he was going?"
Three Tentacle turned to face her.
"Who, Solo?"
Alima nodded.
"Where do you think he was going?"
Three Tentacle retorted.
"To see it, of course."
"It? What are we talking about? Spice dens? Death games?"
Now the second Quarren turned toward her.
"Is that supposed to be a joke? He's here for the same reason everyone is. To see it. The friend."
"The friend, of course."
Alima knew the kind of friends males kept hidden in places like this. The kind they would dare visit only in the anonymous depths of an undercity. She pointed her blowgun out the door, gesturing at the fallen Nikto, then spoke in her force whisper again.
"Your companion was attacked by an intruder," she said. "You saw the intruder kill him, and soon the intruder will want to come inside."
"To kill it?"
the second Quarren gasped.
"Yes, to kill it,"
Alima agreed.
"You must stop the intruder from entering."
Three Tentacle pressed a nerve bundle, closing the door. Then both Quarren pointed their blaster rifles at the heart of the membrane.
"Good,"
Alima said. She turned away from the door, confident the two Quarren had already forgotten her. Alima left the vestibule and entered a warren of winding tunnel-like passages lit by the bioluminescent lichen typical of Yuuzhan Vong converted buildings. She selected the largest, most heavily trodden corridor and started forward at a brisk pace. The air quickly grew hot and dank, and puffs of what smelled like ammonia and sulfur started to roll up the passage. She had just reached a short side passage when the distant shriek of blaster rifles sang down the corridor, the vestibule guards opening fire on her mysterious stalker. Alima peered down the side passage and saw that it opened into something vaguely reminiscent of a Kala'un joy cave, a central chamber surrounded by a number of privacy cells. A strange chorus of snap hisses erupted from the entry vestibule, and the blaster fire ceased as suddenly as it had begun. By the sound of it, whoever was following Alima was using some sort of strange lightsaber technology, and using it well. The Quarren had bought Alima even less time than she had expected. She went down the side passage and was surprised to find no panderer there to greet her, nor any spice dealers, nor any glitter girls waiting for new clients. There wasn't even a beverage center, only a fountain gurgling in the center of the room and a refresher tucked away into a rear alcove. The doors to most of the privacy cells were open, revealing small dens containing beds, nesting basins, or simple raised pallets. But a handful of the cells were closed, and Alima could sense beings in them all. She went to the first, and holding her blowgun ready to shoot, pressed the nerve bundle beside the door. The membrane retracted to reveal a pair of Jeannette curled up on large floor cushions, their limbs pulled in tight and their snouts tucked close to their legs. Neither opened an eye, even when Alima grunted in disbelief. There were no spice pipes in the cell, no aphrodisiacs, not even an empty ale mug. They were sleeping, just sleeping. Alima started back toward the main corridor and glimpsed her pursuer's shadow on the far wall. She ducked out of sight and made sure that her force presence was damped down, then peered around the corner and watched as a thin woman in a scarlet robe came down the corridor. The woman was middle-aged, with red hair and a thin nose, and she kept the lower half of her face concealed behind a black scarf. In one hand, she held a coil of strands, leather and gem-studded metal, attached to what looked like the hilt of a lightsaber. Alima was so shocked that she almost let her feelings spill into the Force. At the Jedi Academy on Yavin 4, she had studied the story of an Imperial agent named Shira Bree. How Bree had attempted to discredit Luke in the eyes of his fellow pilots, only to be shot down and nearly killed. How Darth Vader had rehabilitated her, turning her into as much a machine as he was, then training her in the ways of the Sith. How she had constructed her light whip and returned to trouble Luke Skywalker time after time in her new identity as Lumaya, Dark Lady of the Sith. Could it be that Lumaya had returned once more? Alima saw no room to doubt, and Lumaya was hunting Jason Solo. Alima drew back around the corner, her thoughts whirling as she struggled to sort through the implications. She knew from the history she had studied that Lumaya hated the Skywalkers and Solos almost as much as Alima herself did, so it seemed likely their goals were the same, to destroy the Solo Skywalker clan. But Alima could not permit Lumaya to steal her kills. If the balance was to be served, Alima had to destroy the prey herself. She filled her lungs with air, then raised the blowgun to her lips and spun around the corner to attack. The corridor was empty. Lumaya was gone, vanished as quickly as she had appeared. Alima started down the corridor at a run, growing more worried with each step that Lumaya would beat her to the kill. No longer taking the time to move quietly, barely paying attention to which way she was going, just moving deeper into the building, deeper into the heat and the dankness and that horrid smell of ammonia and sulfur. She emerged onto a narrow mezzanine balcony and found herself gazing across a huge well of yellow fog. It looked nothing like the pleasure den she had been expecting, but she stepped out of the passage and crossed the balcony without hesitation. In typical Yu Zhan Vong fashion, there was no railing to keep pedestrians safe. The Yorick coral floor simply ended 20 meters above a vast pool of steaming slime. A constant supply of bubbles was rising from the depths of the pool, speckling the surface with flashes of light as they burst into scarlet and yellow glimmers. The surrounding walls were mottled with patches of bioluminescent lichen, barely visible through the thick fog. Higher up, several tiers of balconies curved away on both sides and vanished into the steam. Scattered along the balcony edges were the shadowy silhouettes of ferals in the process of tossing animal carcasses or even lifeless bipeds into the pool below. Alima furrowed her brow, trying to decide exactly what she was looking at. She was about to back away when a voice murmured up through the fog. Jason. Let me worry about Renoir and the Bothans. Jason sounded irritated. Leaving the well was foolish. I can't protect you here. The only response Alima heard was a long liquid purl. But Jason responded as though he'd been spoken to. That's ridiculous. I'd know if I'd been followed. Not even Bothan assassins are that good. After another long purl, Jason's voice grew concerned. Inside the building? You're sure? There was a short gurgle. Of course I'd care, Jason replied testily. You're the guard's most valuable asset. Without you, we couldn't track a tenth of the terrorist cells we do now. The fog cleared, and Alima was astonished to see Jason addressing a fleshy black monstrosity that had come up from the slime. The thing was so large, she could not even tell how much of it she was seeing. Its eye had a pupil the size of a Sullustan's head. Its tentacles were as big around as Alima herself. And, like everything in this part of the Undercity, its appearance was distinctly Yu Zhan Vong. The creature blinked and thrashed its tentacles across the surface. I can't ban Bothans from the planet, Jason replied. That would push Botha Wee straight into Corellia's camp. Alima began to suspect what this creature was. While Jason had been held captive by the Yu Zhan Vong, he had supposedly struck up a friendship with the World Brain, a sort of genetic master controller whom the invaders had created to oversee the remaking of Coruscant. Before escaping, Jason had persuaded it to thwart its master's plans, to cooperate only partially in their efforts to reshape Coruscant. Later, during the final days of the war, he had convinced his friend to switch sides and help the Galactic Alliance retake the planet. Now he was using it to spy on Corellian terrorists. Clever boy. Alima raised the blowgun to her lips, and using the force to hide the cone dart, expelled her breath. The dart had just left the blowgun, when somewhere above Alima, and to her right, a throaty female voice cried out, Jason! Jason spun, igniting his lightsaber as he turned. But the dart was tiny, swift, and still hidden in the force, and Alima realized with a bolt of satisfaction that his blade was not rising to block. Then Jason cried out and flew backward, as though hurled by an invisible hand, and the dart flashed past, eliciting a liquid roar of pain as it disappeared into the enormous eye of the World Brain. 5 meters across the well's edge, and one balcony up, stood the fog-blurred silhouette of a thin woman in the scarlet robe. Her arm was still extended toward the slime pool, leaving no doubt that she had been the one who force-hurled Jason to safety. Lumaya. As Alima backed away from the balcony's edge, Lumaya pointed toward her. There, Jason. Alima turned to run, but the fog suddenly flashed blue, and a tremendous crack sounded from behind her. In the next moment, she found herself sliding across the floor, snakes of force lightning dancing across her anguished body until she finally passed from her attacker's sight. Alima did not understand what had just happened. Had Lumaya really warned Jason? Had he been the one who hurled the Force lightning at her? But there was no time to figure it out. She forced her cramped muscles to drag her into the nearest corridor, then rose to a knee and drew a Force shadow over herself. She reached into her pocket for another dart, and that was when she realized the Force lightning had made her drop her blowgun. Jason alit on the edge of the balcony, so obscured by yellow fog that he was barely more than a silhouette. But he was burning with a rage that Alima had not thought possible for him, an anger so fierce that it warmed the Force like fire. He ignited his lightsaber, casting a green reflection that made his eyes shine with murderous intent. His gaze fell on the blowgun, and he started forward. An ear-piercing screech rang out from the well of the world brain. Then a dozen black tentacles rose out of the fog. They began to thrash about wildly, gashing themselves on the balcony and spraying the walls with blood. Jason's eyes darkened to the color of black holes, and he started forward, his gaze shifting to the corridor where Alima was hiding. Though Alima knew she lacked the power to kill Jason with one attack, and that she would not have time for two, she opened herself to the Force, preparing to blast him with lightning. Then, a second silhouette, this one a slender woman with a veiled face, dropped out of the fog. Alima extended her hand. Lumaya was not going to steal her kill. But instead of attacking Jason, Lumaya merely caught him by the arm and spun him toward the thrashing tentacles.
"Jason, those are convulsions," she said. "We have to slow the poison now, or your spy is dead."
Alima's jaw dropped. Lumaya's tone was one of command, a master to a student. "But the assassin!"
"Would you rather have vengeance or preserve an intelligence asset?"
"This isn't about vengeance." Jason looked toward the corridor where Alima was hiding. "It's about justice. We can't let the assassin..."
"The assassin is only the tool,"
Lumaya interrupted again.
"It's the hand wielding her we need to stop. It's Remoir and his lieutenants."
Jason turned away. He and Lumaya danced past the thrashing tentacles of the world brain and dropped into the fog. Even after they were gone, Alima remained in hiding, too shocked to move.
"Jason Solo? Apprenticing with a Sith? Had the galaxy gone mad?"
A long time ago, in a galaxy far, far away.
Random House Audio presents Star Wars, Legacy of the Force, Tempest, by Troy Denning. Read for you by Mark Thompson.
Kyrus Asteroid Cluster, aboard the Corellian Dreadnought Thrakken Cell Solo.
The air aboard the Thrakken Cell Solo was filled with new vessel smells. The acrid bite of ventilation fans burning off packing grease. The sweetness of escaped actuating gas. The ozone tinge of fresh air exchangers. As Han and Leia Solo passed through hatchway after hatchway, Han still found himself touching the Durasteel bulkheads to be sure he wasn't dreaming. The Sal Solo was the flagship of a secret assault fleet that the Corellian government had put into construction nearly 10 standard years before, under the leadership of Han's recently deceased cousin, Thrakken Sal Solo. Nobody would say what Sal Solo and his cohorts had been planning for the mysterious armada, and Han didn't care. The fleet was ready to deploy, and large enough to shatter the Alliance blockade. And that was all that mattered. The blockade had been extended to all 5 planets in the Corellian system, choking their economics and threatening their off-world facilities. When the Solos reached the command center, Han did not need to be a Jedi to feel the excitement in the air.
The door guards inspected everyone's passes with more than the usual cursory nod, and they even ran a security scan on C-3PO. Han leaned close to Leia and asked in a whisper,
"Will you be okay with this?"
Leia looked up and arched a brow.
"Okay with what, Han?"
"Being married to a Corellian admiral."
Han smirked and ran his fingers over his chin, clean-shaven now that there was no longer a need to hide his identity from his cousin's assassins.
"Look around. Wedge is getting ready to bust the blockade, and he's gonna need me to take one of the dreadnoughts."
They reached the door to the planning salon and had to end the conversation. Instead of admitting them immediately, as he had the previous day, the door guard, a square-jawed petty officer in a blue duty uniform, blocked their way.
"The Admiral will be with you as soon as he can, Captain Solo."
"As soon as he can? He called us!"
"Yes, sir, I'm aware of that."
The door guard studied Han with the weary smirk that Corellians reserve for grandstanders and blowhards.
"Admiral Antilles is a very busy man."
"Yeah? Well, so am I."
Before Han could turn to leave, Leia caught him by the arm.
"Tell Admiral Antilles to take his time," she said to the guard. "We understand how busy he must be right now."
Han did not resist as she pulled him to one side of the door. Wedge Antilles had been appointed Supreme Commander of the Corellian Forces some 10 standard days earlier, the day after Thrakken Sal Solo's assassination. And Han knew as well as anyone how hectic his schedule had to be right now. That was why the Solos had been so surprised to receive a message asking them to rendezvous with Antilles in the Kyrus asteroid cluster. The Kyruses were so far out on the fringes of the system that they were almost free-floating, and so obscure that even Han had been forced to ask for coordinates. All their questions had been answered when they rounded Kyrus 6 and saw the Sal Solo floating in your hidden dock. The dreadnought was a typical Corellian design, innovative, austere, and configured for vicious, close-in combat, with turbolaser turrets and missile tubes arrayed heavily and uniformly over a blue, egg-shaped hull. Han had known the moment he saw her that the ship was exactly what Corellia needed, a vessel capable of plunging into the core of the Alliance blockade and tearing it apart from the inside. But Han's pulse had not quickened until a couple of hours later, when Antilles had informed them that the Sal Solo had two sister ships and an entire support fleet hidden in the Kyrus cluster's other shipyards. Given the obvious element of surprise, Antilles felt sure the fleet would be powerful enough to smash the blockade and convince the Alliance to reconsider its war plans. What he had wanted to know from Han was whether he and Leia considered an early end to the war a strong enough possibility to serve in the Corellian military. Han and Leia spent the night agonizing over Antilles' question, worrying about whether Han would eventually find himself in battle against his own children. Jaina was now serving with the Jedi instead of the military, and Jason was supposedly back on Coruscant torturing Corellians. But war had a way of bringing about the unforeseen. If Han ended up killing one of his own children, he would shatter into more pieces than there were stars in the galaxy. The question posed a dilemma for Leia as well. 4 years ago, when her master Saba Sevatine had proclaimed her a Jedi Knight, she had sworn to obey the Jedi Council even when she disagreed with it, and the Council was supporting the Galactic Alliance. The wait was shorter than Han had expected. He had barely started to consider a trip to the calf dispenser when Wedge Antilles arrived in his white admiral's uniform.
"Han, Leia, I'm sorry for the delay," Antilles said. "Have you decided?"
"Yeah, I was kind of thinking of signing on."
"Glad to hear it."
Antilles smiled and stuck out his hand, but there was more apprehension in his face than warmth.
"We have an important job for you. We need you to negotiate a coalition."
"Negotiate?" Han scowled. "I thought you wanted me in the military."
"Maybe later. Right now, this is more important. You understand this can't be an official request."
"Why not?" Han interrupted.
"Because I'm not Corellian," Leia said, "and I'm a Jedi Knight. Would look suspicious for me to conduct negotiations."
"So you want me to be the front man?"
Han continued to look at Antilles.
Antilles nodded.
Exactly.
Not interested, Han said. Call me when you need someone to do some fighting.
He turned to leave, but Leia caught him by the arm.
Han, shouldn't we hear Admiral Antilles out?
What for?
For Corellia.
Leia fixed him with a stern-eyed gaze that worked better on him than any Jedi Force suggestion.
You're always talking about the importance of preserving Corellia's independent spirit. Is sitting at a negotiating table really so much to ask?
He scowled.
You want to do this?
I'm willing to consider it.
Leia turned back to Antilles.
But we're not making a decision before we hear the details. All the details.
No one expects that, Antilles smiled. My orders were simply to find out if you'd be willing to consider it. Prime Minister Gedgen will brief you on the rest.
Antilles led the way into the planning salon, a spacious cabin lined with the latest battle coordination technology, half-wall display screens, a ceiling-mounted tactical holoprojector, automatic cap dispensers in each corner. Dur Gedgen and two others sat talking at a large oval conference table with a combination data comm station at every seat. As soon as Han and Leia entered the room, Gedgen ended the conversation and extended his hand.
Captain Solo, welcome. I'm so pleased you agreed to accept this assignment.
Yeah, well, don't be too pleased, Han said. I haven't accepted anything yet.
He gave Gedgen's hand a single pump, then looked past him to the others. They were older. The first a sandy-haired man with a blocky jaw and graying mustache. The second a middle-aged woman with a round face and cold gray eyes. Han wasn't familiar enough with the new government to recognize them by sight, but he was guessing by Antilles' displeasure and the number of security agents waiting outside that they were Gavel Lamora and Rorf Willems. Along with Gedgen, Lamora and Willems were the heart of the Five Worlds government, with Lamora serving as Minister of Intelligence and Willems as the Minister of Defense. Gedgen frowned in Antilles' direction.
I thought you weren't to bring them in here unless...
Admiral Antilles' request was necessarily rather vague, Leia interrupted. Han will need to know a few more details before he can agree to serve as your emissary.
Ah, of course.
Gedgen glanced over his shoulder at the cold-eyed woman, Lamora, and looked relieved.
We'll be happy to give him a basic briefing.
Gedgen motioned Han and Leia to chairs. Antilles took a seat at the end of the table, a choice that suggested he really did not like being a part of this conversation.
I assume you recognized Ministers Lamora and Willems.
Han nodded.
Yeah. I was just wondering what could bring the entire High Cabinet all the way out here.
We're on an inspection tour.
Lamora did not even bother trying to sound plausible.
What matters to you is that a unique opportunity has presented itself.
Before Han could threaten to leave because he didn't like being lied to, Gedgen dropped the bombshell.
Queen Mother Tenel Ka has agreed to meet a Corellian delegation.
Yeah, sure.
You can't be serious.
Han and Leia spoke at the same time. For the only thing that might have surprised them more or caused more doubt was to hear Gedgen claiming that their son Anakin had not really died fighting the Yuuzhan Vong. Tenel Ka was a vocal and very loyal supporter of the Galactic Alliance, and any suggestion that she might be willing to discuss changing sides was crazy.
I assure you, we are serious, Gedgen said. The High Cabinet did not come out here to play a practical joke on you.
Then someone fed you a bad set of coordinates, Han replied. There's no way Tenel Ka is going to support Corellia. She's already assigned two battle fleets to Alliance Command.
Gedgen was not deterred.
And if that were to change, the Galactic Alliance would be forced to reconsider its position regarding Corellia.
The invitation is real,
Lamora assured them.
The Queen Mother has half a day available on the 20th. Can you reach Hapes by then?
Sure.
Han glanced toward the end of the table and found Antilles gazing into the corner, apparently contemplating the wonders of automatic calf dispensers.
If there's any sense in going.
I think what Han means to say is the offer sounds suspicious.
Leia looked to Han as though for confirmation, but she was really signaling him to play along.
We both know Tenel Ka well enough to be certain that she'll never change sides.
You see, that's why you're perfect for this job, Willem said. If anyone has a chance of talking some sense into her, it's you two.
Han did not like the menacing note he heard in Willem's gravelly voice.
You better not be sending us there to threaten her, he said, because that would steam me about as much as it would Tenel Ka.
Gedgen waved a calming hand. Nobody's making threats, Captain Solo, but we do have some intelligence that suggests her support of the Alliance is straining her relationship with her nobles.
We assume that's why she's willing to talk, Lamora added. Perhaps she's merely putting on a show to placate them or trying to buy some time, but we can't afford to ignore the opening.
No, of course not, Leia said. But Admiral Antilles said you were asking Han to negotiate a coalition. You do understand there's no chance of that happening, don't you?
If there is any hope, you're it, Gedgen replied. But we don't need a coalition, and neither does Queen Mother Tenel Ka.
If Apes were to make an open statement of neutrality and withdraw her fleet from Alliance command, Lamora said, Corellia's position would be strengthened both militarily and politically. Other governments might be emboldened enough to support us openly.
And Tenel Ka's nobles would no longer have grounds to challenge her decision, or her throne, Leia surmised. Is the threat to her that severe?
We hear there are rumblings.
Gedgen leaned forward and deliberately locked gazes with Leia.
It might not be an exaggeration to say that persuading the Queen Mother to assume a favorable stance toward Corellia would be as much a service to her as to us.
Aboard Jaina Solo's Stealth X, stationed near asteroid Curis 17.
Jaina Solo did not want to leave her dream bubble. She was with Jagged Fell, deep in the heart warmth of their nest, their heads still throbbing to the rhythm of the little dawn rumble, their bodies filled with the sweet heat of Killik mating pheromones. All the galaxy's troubles seemed far away, and their battle in the skies of Tanupe had never happened. For once they were together and at peace, with nothing to do but listen to the sweet sound of... alarm bells? The bell was chiming inside Jaina's skull, shaking the dream bubble until it popped, calling her back from her forced hibernation into the icy freefall of reality. She opened her eyes and found herself staring at the frost-rimmed interior of a StealthX canopy, her teeth chattering so hard she thought they might shatter. She felt queasy and sore and muddle-headed. And even in the frigid conditions, the cockpit smelled stale and sour.
Okay, Sneaker, I'm awake, Jaina said. You can turn up the heater and the air scrubbers.
The Astromech, a replacement for Sneaky, whom she had lost when Jag and his squadron shot her down on Tanupe, beeped an acknowledgement, and warm air began to pour into the Stealth X's cockpit. Jaina expanded her force awareness. As her mind cleared, she felt her wingmate, Zek, also awakening. He had resigned his commission in Rogue Squadron a couple of weeks earlier, when Jason had attempted to court-martial Jaina for refusing to fire on a helpless blockade runner. Now he and Jaina were a part of a Jedi reconnaissance team, spying on the secret Corellian shipyards in the Kyrus asteroid cluster. About a kilometer ahead of Zek's Stealth X tumbled the inky darkness of Kyrus 17, which marked the upper limit of the Kyrus asteroid cluster.
What do we have, Sneaker? Jaina asked.
A message appeared on the now defrosted display, informing Jaina that a light transport was departing the cluster. Jaina frowned.
You pulled us out of hibernation for a single vessel?
Sneaker displayed another message. Contact profile is unique. Vessel is overpowered CEC YT-1300. Exhibiting sudden change to possible outbound trajectory. Efflux signature suggests military-grade exhaust nozzles.
The Falcon?
Jaina was not all that surprised. Of course Han and Leia Solo would be in the thick of things. She just hoped they did not return to the Curuses before Admiral Buatu sprang his trap. So far, the Corellians did not seem to realize that the Galactic Alliance knew of their secret fleet. And when the Kira's fleet finally left base, the Corellians were going to be in for a nasty shock.
Are you sure?
Affirmative. Trajectory is now confirmed outbound. Zek's stealth X suddenly started after the Falcon. Jaina shoved her own throttles forward and shot after Zek, at the same time reaching out to him in the Force. Though their telepathic joiner bond had finally dissolved a couple of years before, she and Zek remained so acutely attuned to each other that they could often communicate through the Jedi battle meld more clearly than most people conversed, and she quickly understood his intentions. Equal parts spy and assault craft, Stealth X starfighters were equipped with eavesdropping equipment, so sensitive it could intercept stray signals from a vessel's internal computers. If Zek could close the distance before the Falcon jumped to hyperspace, he might be able to capture enough data from the Solo's nav computer to determine their destination. What Zek did not intend to do, he assured Jaina, was vapor parents. Kira 17 slid past above, drawing a momentary curtain of darkness over Jaina's canopy. Then there was nothing between the Stealth X's and their target, except 100 kilometers of empty space. The Falcon was really moving. The Falcon's efflux trail slowly changed from a tail to a solid bar. Jaina activated her eavesdropping array, then instructed Sneaker to inform her when he began to pick up signals. Finally, the outline of the Falcon's sensor dish grew visible above the brilliant glow of her ion drives, and Sneaker reported that the eavesdropping array was picking up stray signals. Jaina and Zek strengthened their contact and swung out to opposite sides of the target, then felt a wave of astonishment roll through the meld as Leia discerned its presence. Jaina pulled out immediately, and, astonished by her mother's force sensitivity, tried to make her presence very small. Her eavesdropping array lit up as it began to capture and record electronic pulses from inside the Falcon. An instant later, she sensed Leia searching for her and tried to draw in on herself even further. But there was no hiding from one's own mother. Not when that mother was Leia Solo, anyway. Jaina felt a brief moment of warmth, followed by an overwhelming sense of relief and, oddly, reassurance. Then the battered old transport shot away, her ion tail thinning into nothingness as she vanished into hyperspace. Sneaker beeped for Jaina's attention, then scrolled a message across the display, announcing that he had analyzed the intercepted data and used his superior computing power to develop a list of the Falcon's most likely destinations. A list of planet names began to scroll down the display. Arabanth, Cheruba, Drina, Galanor.
"Those are all in the Hapes Consortium," Jaina cried.
Sneaker confirmed that they were, then apologized for not pinpointing the destination more exactly. The transitory mists that enveloped the consortium made hyperspace lanes such a tangle that once a vessel entered Hapen territory, evaluating what course it would follow was statistically impossible.
"That's okay," Jaina replied. "You're close enough."
The Jedi Temple Sparring Arena, Coruscant.
It was the moment Mara had been dreaming of and dreading for years. The first time father and son entered the Jedi Temple sparring arena with live blades. But she had never imagined it would be like this, with Luke so determined to teach rather than train, and with Ben so resentful and frightened. It made her fear for them both, made her wish that she could be down on the arena floor, instead of up here in a hot control booth packed with glide levers, toggle switches, and actuating buttons. The far door of the arena opened, and Luke entered. Walking to the center of the floor, he glanced up at the control booth and flashed Mara a reassuring smile, then stood waiting for Ben. The sparring arena was basically a bowl-shaped chamber filled with balance beams, various kinds of swings, and repulsor-floated wobble balls. Interior conditions such as temperature and lighting could be changed from the control booth, and an automatic safety field caught anybody who started to fall out of control. The near door opened, and Ben entered, his blue eyes sweeping the vault, examining everything in the chamber but his opponent,
Despite his obvious apprehension, Ben marched straight to the center of the vault, and Mara was struck by how mature her 13-year-old son had become. He bowed formally, then said,
"Apprentice Skywalker reporting for sparring instruction as ordered, Master."
Luke raised his eyebrows at Ben's use of the title apprentice, but did not correct him.
"Very good."
Luke snapped the lightsaber off his utility belt and looked upward toward the control booth.
"Start with basic obstacles,"
Luke ordered.
"Then work up to a Class 5 environment."
"Full hazard?" Mara asked in astonishment. "Are you sure?"
"I'm sure,"
Luke answered in his best, "Are you really questioning the Grand Master voice?" He looked back to Ben.
"How else can I test what Jason has been teaching him?" "Don't worry, Mom."
Ben met his father's gaze evenly, but the crack in his voice betrayed his apprehension.
"I can handle it."
Not likely, Mara thought.
"If you say so."
Mara had to let Ben make his own mistakes and learn his own lessons. Luke, too. Wasn't that what the Force was telling her?
"We'll start with variable gravity, and I'll add something every 90 seconds. Ready?"
Ben's face paled, but he snapped the lightsaber off his belt.
"Ready."
Luke felt his knees tense as Mara pushed the gravity to 2 G's. He could sense through the Force that she doubted he was doing the right thing, that she believed he should just talk with Ben and help him see how Jason was slipping toward darkness. But Luke had tried talking, had been patient, and their son was still going on raids with the Galactic Alliance Guard. Ben had even killed a man in self-defense, and the fact that he had been in so much danger only made it more disturbing. Luke did not want his son to grow up believing that such things were common necessities for Jedi. The time had come to show Ben that there was another way, a better way, for someone strong in the Force to use his power. "All right, son," Luke said. "Let's see how well Jason has been training you." Ben brought the hilt of his lightsaber into the salute position, but did not ignite the blade.
"You know I don't want to do this, right?"
"It's hard to miss." Luke remained where he was, holding his own weapon at his side.
"Why not?"
Ben shrugged and refused to meet Luke's eyes.
"They just don't."
"Are you afraid I'll hurt you?"
"Yeah, right."
Ben's voice was sarcastic.
"The greatest sword handler in the galaxy accidentally cuts up his own son? Like that's gonna happen."
Luke had to force himself to keep a serious expression.
"Then you're afraid you'll hurt me?
Is that it?"
"Maybe."
Ben nodded uncomfortably.
"By accident."
Luke waited for Ben's gaze to return, then said,
"You won't. Have some faith, okay?"
Ben's cheeks reddened.
"I do,"
he said.
"But I'm still afraid. Something feels wrong about this."
"Something is wrong about this," Luke said. "You shouldn't be going on hunts with Jason. You shouldn't be a member of GAG, and you sure shouldn't be busting down doors and killing people. You're too young." Ben's face hardened, not with the resentment Luke had expected, but with resolve.
"I'm not quitting GAG. Jason needs me. The Alliance needs me."
"Then show me you're ready." Luke brought his lightsaber to guard, but did not activate it.
"If I have to."
Ben ignited his own blade, then frowned when Luke did not do the same.
"Aren't you going to turn on your lightsaber?"
"When I need to," Luke said. "When you make me." A gleam of understanding came to Ben's eye, and he stepped forward with a high slash. The double gravity slowed the attack, and Luke had plenty of time to contemplate the hesitation he saw in his son's eyes. Luke evaded the attack by dropping into a squat, then thrust his foot out to sweep Ben's leading leg out from beneath him. Ben slammed to the floor, then cleared the area by whipping his blade in a circle around his body. The boy might not be much at sparring, but he did know how to fight. Had Luke not already launched himself into a backward spring, the attack would have taken his legs off at the knees. He landed just beyond reach and allowed Ben's blade to sweep past, then stepped forward again and deadened the brachial nerve bundle by kicking Ben under the arm, hard. Ben's hand opened, and the blade of his lightsaber fizzled out as the hilt went spinning across the vault. Luke somersaulted 3 meters up to land atop a balance beam. "You'll have to do better than that, son," he said. "You won't force me to ignite my blade by swinging short." Ben's face reddened, more from embarrassment than irritation. Then he sprang to his feet and tried to reach toward his lightsaber. When his sword arm failed to rise, the nerves would still be numb from Luke's kick, he extended his other hand and summoned the weapon back to it. He activated the blade and took a few test swings to make sure his one-handed grip was dry and firm, then looked up at the balance beam where Luke was standing.
"I don't understand why you're doing this."
"Yes, you do," Luke said. "I need to know you can defend yourself."
"Then why am I doing all the attacking?"
Ben demanded.
"That's not going to tell you anything."
"It'll tell me plenty." Luke pointed at a wobble ball floating nearby, then used the force to send it hurling at Ben. "There are many kinds of danger." Ben ducked the projectile and force sprang into the air. Luke hurled another wobble ball, and this time Ben had to block, bringing his lightsaber around to slice the ball in two. He landed on the far end of the balance beam, and that was when Mara turned on the wind. The sudden blast was nearly enough to knock Luke from the beam, but Ben merely leaned into the wind and started cautiously forward. Luke rooted himself to the beam through the force, then glanced up at another wobble ball and brought it flying down at his son from behind. Ben's eyes widened as he sensed danger through the force, and he flattened himself atop the beam. In the next moment, he used a force shove to accelerate the heavy wobble ball into Luke's chest and send him tumbling toward the floor. On the way down, Luke caught the support cable of a nearby swing and hooked a leg over the seat, then saw Ben descending toward him in a series of somersaults, his lightsaber weaving a wild snarl of light. This time, Luke sensed no hesitation. Luke released the swing and dropped toward the floor, barely bringing his legs around in time to land on his feet, sinking so deep into a crouch that his knees hit his chest. Ben used the force to adjust his own trajectory, descending headfirst with his lightsaber held out in front of him. Luke rolled into a backward somersault, an eerie tingle erupting over his entire body as the safety field reacted to Ben's uncontrolled plunge. But the safety field did not prevent Ben's lightsaber from puncturing the floor. A loud electrical pop echoed through the arena, and suddenly the air was filled with the acrid stench of melted circuitry. Ben studied the hole for a moment, then looked back to Luke.
"You can't blame me for that. You're the one who didn't block."
"I will next time, I promise." Luke assumed a fighting stance and motioned him forward. "Come on." Ben furrowed his brow, but slipped into a fighting stance and began to circle behind Luke. Luke closed his eyes and concentrated on the drone of the lightsaber, all the time tracking Ben's presence through the force, waiting for the telltale flicker of resolve that would mean his son was attacking. It did not come until Ben was directly behind him, where Luke would be forced to pivot to see the attack. But Luke didn't need to see. He merely listened until the drone of the lightsaber began to change pitch, then raised his free hand and made a grasping motion, grabbing the hilt of Ben's weapon through the force and holding it motionless 2 meters away. Ben grunted in surprise, but he was both resourceful and quick. Luke heard the lightsaber deactivate as the hilt was released, then felt his son flying toward the center of his back. He dropped his own lightsaber and turned his weapon hand toward the floor, rooting himself to the force. Ben struck an instant later, kicking out with both feet in an attempt to send Luke flying. Luke did not budge, and Ben hit the floor with another loud thump. "Rotter!" Luke remained motionless, but he opened his eyes and summoned Ben's lightsaber into his grasp. "Does that mean you give up?"
"Not yet."
Luke sensed another flicker of excitement in the force, then glanced over his shoulder to see Ben summoning the lightsaber Luke had dropped just a moment earlier. When it arrived, Ben hefted its weight a couple of times, then scowled and opened the base. Nothing came out. Ben turned to Luke in astonishment.
"You couldn't activate the blade,"
he complained.
"There's no power cell."
"No, there isn't." Luke turned to face his son full on. "A Jedi's greatest weapon is his mind." Ben's face grew red.
"So I've heard."
He rose and handed Luke's lightsaber to him.
"Thanks for rubbing my nose in it."
Luke returned Ben's weapon to him.
"That's not what I was doing."
"I know what you were doing, Dad. You had to test me." Ben returned the lightsaber to his utility belt, then added, "But I'm not going dark. Anger has no control over me, and neither does fear."
Luke nodded.
"I can see that, Ben. I still want you to take a proper master."
"Then make Jason a master,"
Ben replied.
"He knows more about the Force than anybody."
"That's not going to happen, Ben,"
Luke said.
Ben considered this a moment, then spoke in a resigned voice.
"I guess that's your decision, Dad. You're the Grand Master."
He started to gather up his sparring armor.
"I've got to get going. We've got a raid at 2000.
"Ben, I wish you..."
"I have to, Dad. They're counting on me."
Ben stood and started toward the door, then suddenly stopped and faced Luke.
"But I could use some more sparring, if you've got the time."
"Sure."
Luke was as surprised by the peace offering as he was delighted.
"I'd like that a lot."
"Me too."
Ben turned away, then called over his shoulder.
"But you'd better bring a power cell. Next time, I won't go so easy on you."
Aboard the Admiral Ackbar, Admiral Boitu's flagship, stationed 3 light-years from the Kyrus asteroid cluster.
After a long mission force hibernating in the cold, cramped cockpit of a Stealth X, what Jaina wanted was a hot Stannis team and a nerf stake as large as her plate. What she got, as she passed the fastidious officers on the command deck of the Admiral Ackbar, were sudden glances and sometimes wrinkled noses. She was still wearing the same black flight suit in which she had spent the last week, and the climate-controlled warmth of the Star Destroyer was doing nothing to mask the fact. Jaina stopped at the edge of the tactical salon and waited for Admiral Boitu to free himself. The tactical holodisplay in the center of the salon suggested that the Corellian situation had not changed during her week at the observation post. Fleets enforcing the Alliance exclusionary zone still surrounded Centerpoint Station and all 5 of Corell's habitable planets, and the Kyrus asteroid cluster continued to glow in faint, cautionary yellow. The location of Boitu's ambush fleet, lying in wait 3 light-years from the edge of the system, was indicated by a simple blue arrow and a distance marker. Jaina looked from the holodisplay to a niche high on the salon's back wall, where a larmel stone bust of the great Admiral Ackbar kept watch over his namesake. She knew enough about the political instincts of Bothans to realize Boitu was only displaying the statue to curry favor with the Alliance's new Mon Calamari Supreme Commander, Cha Nyathol. Jaina sensed Boitu approaching and turned her attention in the Admiral's direction. With small burning eyes and graying chin fur, the Bothan cut a feral and surprisingly dignified figure in his white uniform.
"A reminder,"
Boitu said in his gritty voice. Jaina frowned in bafflement.
"Sir?"
Boitu pointed a finger at the bust of Admiral Ackbar.
"The statue,"
he said.
"It has nothing to do with Admiral Nyathol, as you were thinking. It's there to keep me humble."
Jaina was too surprised to ask Boitu exactly how he knew what she had been thinking.
"Humble?" she asked. "How is that, sir?"
The fur rose along the back of Boitu's neck.
"Jedi can't possibly be that poorly informed. I was the laughingstock of the entire Space Navy over the incident in the Murgo choke."
"Not the entire Space Navy, sir," Jaina said.
During the recent peacekeeping operations in the unknown regions, the Ackbar had been captured by a swarm of Killick commandos, smuggled aboard in busts of Admiral Boitu himself.
"I'm pretty sure Admiral Pelion didn't find it all that funny."
"No, he didn't,"
Boitu said.
"As a matter of fact, I'm surprised the old battle can let me keep my command."
"The Killick certainly wished he hadn't," Jaina said.
Boitu studied her with narrowed eyes, no doubt wondering whether there remained enough joiner in Jaina to wish that the Killicks had prevailed in their war against the Chiss.
"What I'm trying to say is that your performance after the Ackbar's capture was brilliant," Jaina clarified. "Nobody else could have stopped those Nest ships in the Murgo choke."
Boitu's expression grew pleased.
"Probably not. No one else would have moved so quickly to exploit the enemy's uncertainty, especially in the face of such overwhelming...
The Admiral stopped and glanced